Hello, my name is Matt Hassan, and I am a director of M&A at Equitech. On behalf of Equitech and Kimball Applications, I am pleased to introduce our esteemed guest, Gillian Sheeran, who is the Chief Financial Officer of London-based investment banking consultancy Rule Financial. Gillian joined Rule Financial in late 2010 and helped guide the company through a period of challenges and successes leading up to GFT Technologies' acquisition of Rule Financial in June 2014. It is this period, as well as the dynamics surrounding the sale process, that we'll be discussing with Gillian today. And with that, why don't we jump right in to our discussion with Gillian. Hi, Gillian. How are you?
Hi, Matt. Hi, Matt. I'm grand. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. So the first question I have is, I understand that 2011, which was your first full year at Rule Financial, was quite a challenging year for the company. Can you please tell me what issues the company was dealing with at that time?
Of course. I'd be delighted to discuss my personal view of the Rule journey. I joined Rule, as you mentioned, in late 2010, and 2011 was a very, very tough year for the business. 2010 had been their best year to date, with revenues of around 37 million sterling. However, around 50% of this revenue was focused with one client, and as you can imagine, client concentration became a hot topic in the Rule boardroom during 2010. The risk was definitely known and was unfortunately realized in early 2011. That main client underwent a staff reshuffle, which resulted in a new CIO, and he radically reduced business with Rule. It was fairly devastating for us. The revenue dropped from 37 million in 2010 to 32 million in 2011 with an EBITDA of 1.9%.
Wow. Okay. So yeah, that is certainly a difficult situation, having that risk of heavy customer concentration actually come to life and seeing that revenue fall away instantly. Now, I understand that you had identified customer concentration as a big risk even before the loss of this account, and had already begun taking certain steps to mitigate this risk. If you would, can you please elaborate on some of these measures?
Yeah, of course. So the board, as I mentioned, had realized that client concentration was a risk. And during 2010, when the times were good, the board and management took the time to review where the company was going and to define what Rule wanted to achieve in the next few years. Quite standard, and quite a few of the changes that came out of this strategic review, and in terms of mitigating client concentration, the main action was an investment in account management. In practice, this meant creating a few more account manager positions, and they were directly ordered to farm business and to quit hunting. These positions were created around a handful of key accounts in which we believed there was opportunity. These key accounts were analyzed separately in the monthly financial reporting package. We set targets around these accounts. We tied those targets into the account manager's remuneration. And then every year we reviewed the selection of those key accounts, and those that were working remained key accounts. And those in which we'd not generated enough traction were dropped, and other accounts chosen to be a focus for the next year. So, just to recap on that a little bit, we commenced account management focus in 2010 when the times were good. So in 2011, when our main client dropped us, and that drop actually was around 40% of a reduction in our revenues, we made up for that because we've been growing the other accounts. So actually, overall, the shortfall ended up only being 14%.
Okay, well, kudos to you and your team for having that foresight and for partially ameliorating an otherwise potentially devastating set of circumstances. Now, having finished 2011 with that drop in revenue, you bounced back tremendously in 2012 and 2013 with some exceptional top line and bottom line growth. I'd love for you to elaborate on how you accomplished this impressive feat.
Yes, it does sound very impressive, doesn't it? Those years were fantastic from a growth perspective. They were a lot of hard work. We achieved 25% top-line increases, and we managed to boost the EBITDA margin. Before I delve into that success, though, and or into what drove that success, I'd like to illustrate that change with a picture. So if you can imagine, back in 2010, when the board planned that strategic review I mentioned earlier, Ruel was a very, very simple business. It was a London-based business. It employed less than 230 people, and over 90% of those staff were based in London and could walk to their clients' offices. The clients were close. We dealt mainly in sterling. Most of our business was T&M. Most of our business was staff augmentation. Also importantly, unlike most small businesses, Ruel worked the ebbs and flow of whichever customers we could get, i.e. customers were in insurance, were in legal, were in financial. We actually had some retail ones. It was a bit haphazard. However, within 2 years, we were transforming that into a very different beast. By the time we sold the company, Ruel was a capital market-focused global consulting, in the true sense of the word consulting, entity. We had 850 people in offices in 8 different cities in 6 different countries, with over half our staff based in our nearshore centers. So that illustrates how big the change was. And there were many small decisions that enabled that change, but 5 of the big ones would be the focus on capital markets, focus on proper consulting in inverted commas, so thought leadership and taking the problem from the client, building nearshore operations, turning the US entity around, making that a positive contribution to the company, and also reviewing and revising our internal infrastructure. So if I take each of those major decisions and I can elaborate on them one by one. One of the first decisions was to specialize in the capital markets sector. Of course, in practice, over the next year or two, we did end up taking a few projects outside that sector, but it became very few and very far between. Slowly then, our business morphed into one that was focused on just that financial sector. And in so doing, we had some very, very knowledgeable, talented, and experienced financial technical consultants. The key thing about these guys was not only did they understand the IT involved in our projects, but they also had great knowledge of the banking regs driving these changes. And also as part of this new direction, we hired a new marketing manager who rebranded us to sector specialists and actively pushed our brand and enlivened our marketing, which hadn't been that much of a focus up until this point. So those two things proved very advantageous over the next 2 years from a commercial perspective, particularly in light of the avalanche of regulatory changes that went through the market at that time, and also it was a huge benefit when we looked to sell. Another key decision which helped improve margin enormously was to step away from simply supplying staff to a customer, i.e. helping them fill holes in their teams. During 2012 and 2013, we strove very hard to position ourselves as the company who could help you solve the problem. This type of work is definitely more risky. It's usually on a fixed price basis, but it's also more lucrative. So what we ended up doing as a management team was spending a lot of time debating how to manage this risk correctly, both before, during, and after these projects, and how to estimate enough of a risk buffer in our deal calculator. And in the end, it paid off. Another key strategic move was to build up our nearshore operations. During 2011, we predicted that the reliance on farshore operations by our customers was not going as well as had been anticipated. So we decided to focus on a nearshore proposition. On the European side, we had already purchased a small Polish operation back in 2009. It was less than 20 people, and we hadn't made a success out of it at all. But now that we thought, okay, nearshore proposition is going to be the next big thing, we started to invest in it quite heavily. We moved to better offices, we ramped up recruitment, we ramped up the standard of our recruitment and the standard of the people we were employing. And we purchased high-quality equipment so the customer would be impressed with the comms and the abilities of our teams. Also, the cultural similarities between Poland and the UK were far greater than with offshore operations, and our clients liked the fact they could travel there and back in one day. So very, very quickly, we found ourselves in the happy, yes, very stressful position of not being able to staff quickly enough to meet customer demand. In the US, we discovered that the Polish operation was not a strong enough proposition for the New York-based clients. And this was partly due to the travel time, so it still is a long haul flight from New York to Poland, But mainly due to the time zone difference and a 9-to-5 working culture in Poland, which we couldn't change. So after substantial research, we chose Costa Rica, not only for the sun, but also because it was closer to the New York market. Now, initially, we had to buy the business into this new base, either by selling at a low margin or overstaffing the projects, so staffing them with very experienced consultants. This is a tactic we used both in New York and in Costa Rica, and it did seriously limit our margins. But over time, we gained repeat business from these clients, and we started to create margin improvement. At the start of 2012, we also purchased a small US and Canadian operation. And the team that came with this operation made a huge impact. They doubled the annual revenue in 9 months, while also taking this loss-making subsidiary back into the black. With the confidence in this new team, we then started to debate and decide and structure ourselves to cope with global accounts, to deliver a better service to our clients, and to manage the political and technical complexity of global account management, both within our organization and within our clients. The internal infrastructure was also reviewed, which resulted in a change in the delivery team structure, and also a key decision was made to update the technical infrastructure of the company, although we actually didn't end up doing that until 2012.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you for all that context. Obviously, some very critical strategic decisions that were made, in order to realize that growth and lots of success stories within all that. So I appreciate you elaborating on that. With respect to the U.S. operations in particular, what would you say was the critical factor that led to such a successful turnaround? I think you mentioned that the annual profit or the annual revenue doubled in 9 months. What were the critical success factors there?
Okay, so to answer that question, I should backtrack slightly and talk about the fact that before 2012, we had not been able to make a good dent in the New York market at all. We struggled on and off for years. I think we set up there around 2008. And we realized that we needed a local hotshot who had contacts and cultural know-how, etc. However, no hotshot we headhunted was that interested in joining a very small outpost of the UK operation. Type of hotshot we wanted was looking for something different to what we could offer, i.e. a lot more revenue responsibility in a well-known brand. And so we went round and round in circles until in late 2011, things took a positive turn for us. We met with a few ex-Sapient consultants who'd gone out and founded their own company, and they were doing very well, even though the company was only, I think, 7 months old at the time we acquired it, because they had the contacts and they had the cultural know-how what they wanted to do is they wanted to leapfrog the early years. They wanted to bypass the development of infrastructure stage and just focus on growing their commercial business. And we could offer them that. We'd already set up in New York. We had that infrastructure. And so in March 2012, we signed a deal with them and they came on board. The result of this locally connected and respected leadership was very positive. I mean, I mentioned they joined in March, and by the end of that year, they had doubled our US revenues and taken us into the black. And after that, we always followed that rule. So when we set up in Costa Rica, we hired a talented local who was well-connected, professional, successful. It's what we did in Poland. We just kept doing that because it was the only way that we could see to make it successful quickly.
Sure. And in our experience, we see this all the time, that those clients that place an emphasis on nearshore capabilities tend to be better positioned to win business, due to faster and more cost-effective service delivery. So, it's a good validation of that strategy and the successes that you had and your ability to replicate that success in other markets. It seems to me that the company's organizational structure and geographic presence were quite important. Can you shed some light on how structure and geographic strategy were paramount factors in the company's growth and success?
Of course. Organizing ourselves from a geographic perspective was relatively easy. We already owned two small subsidiaries in Poland and Spain. We decided to ramp up Poland to serve the UK market. We had Canadian and US sales offices, So the nearshore operation in Costa Rica solely focused on servicing those two sales offices. However, marrying the reality of this geography to our capital markets-focused sector specialist brand was a whole other cup of tea. Where we ended up at the end was with our senior and most expensive consultants, who were the regulatory and capital market experts, you know, who could talk about Basel and all the other legislation to our clients very easily. They were sitting in the US and the UK, and the junior guys were based in Costa Rica and Poland. Of course, I'm taking a very general view here. Our guys in Poland were skilled, or were learning to be skilled in banking technology, and were streets ahead of our competitors. However, they would not have understood the regulatory framework so well. And then, of course, we had our Spanish operation, and we focused that entirely on building IP and on working on particular technologies, as that was the skill set available in Barcelona at the time.
That's very interesting. Now, following an exceptional 2012 and an excellent start to 2013, the board decided to embark on a sale transaction process, which culminated in June 2014 with the acquisition of Rule by Germany-based GFT Technologies. I must ask, as the CFO of a company going through a sale process, what was top of mind for you throughout this period?
A lot of things were going through my mind during that process, but I guess my personal, and it's always a personal view, my personal three main concerns were maintaining business performance, cash flow management in the face of continual expansion and investment, and also the provision of accurate budgets and forecasts, which were ambitious but achievable. During 2013 and 2014, cash flow was very tight, and cash flow management was very much at the forefront of my mind. Rule had always been a cash type business. I mean, so just to give us a little bit of perspective, as an example, from the date of hiring, it took on average 9.5 months for one of our senior UK consultants to turn cash positive. This is because of onboarding delays, the nature of accounts payable teams and our institutional customers and other factors. So we already monitored forecasts and managed working capital and cash flow very tightly and carefully. I had plans A to D in case of emergencies in the UK, which I very fortunately never had to use. However, as time went on, I thought it would be prudent to negotiate with US banks to set up a US CID or some sort of sales factoring system over there. And I had, so during this period, 2013-2014, I had just commenced these discussions when the board decided to sell. And when they decided to sell in mid-2013, they believed they would sell by Christmas. So in order to facilitate this new priority, the sale of the company, I ditched the US sales factoring negotiations. This was around mid-2013. And then in autumn 2013, the exec team wanted to establish a new base in Poland, accelerate another one. We had just set up Costa Rica, and there was this new strong recruitment demand to hire at every level, everywhere. So managing all these demands, the timings, cash, worlds, while also going through the sales process was quite challenging. One of the reasons we actually managed to continue so well during this period was due to a recent implementation of a time-to-invoice Salesforce-based system called Kimball. So we went live with that on the 1st of July 2013. And we did suffer a little bit of a lag in invoicing at the start. However, it made such an impact to my working capital that overall the 2013 accounts showed our best debtor days ever. And I believe this was because of the impact it had on our invoicing process, from the initial sales confirmation, getting the invoice out the door, being able to track WIP in real time in a much easier fashion and therefore chase the debt. It just had a huge impact and helped enormously at that time. So the other concerns I had around this time were managing business performance and also creating those budgets and forecasts. Maintaining business performance was a grave concern. The last thing you want during a sales process is to suffer a couple of bad months. Obviously, this would have a grave effect on negotiations. So I guess this ties into the third concern, which was creating budgets and forecasts, which were very ambitious, yet achievable. And we did actually manage to do this. We created a very bullish budget and hit every month, January to June 2014. And they were the key negotiating months. And we sold 26th of June 2014. In fact, we achieved the 2014 annual budget top-line number for the whole year and also the aggressive EBITDA percentage that went with it. And one of the reasons we achieved this, again, was due to Kimball. So as I said, we implemented Kimball mid-2013 and immediately started to interrogate our business and understand it on a different level, in a different way. And this provided us with very accurate, up-to-date and insightful view of our business. It also changed the way in which we worked. So for example, we allowed our senior managers access to real-time reports. Previously, they had reviewed monthly reports, so the numbers they were reviewing were out of date by a couple of weeks. And it meant that they felt they didn't have control because it was in the past. And the numbers they were reviewing were already gone, finished. So with the implementation of Kimball, they began to act immediately on issues with which we in finance had previously struggled to persuade them were key challenges. For example, managers were switching resources on projects to drive profit margin while not affecting quality and in a much more speedy fashion. And we had been trying to persuade them to do that for a very long time, but it was always in the past, whereas now they're able to action it in the present. So this directly drove margin improvement in some of our core disciplines. Another reason the budget was achieved was actually a bit of luck, because by the time we did the budget of 2014, the exec team had worked together for quite a while. And at this point, we knew each other very well, and budgeting is all about psychology. So the CEO and myself were able to gauge who naturally is very bullish, who's bearish, and push those in the right direction without diminishing enthusiasm too much. So we could then balance the different sensibilities off each other so that the budget as a whole was ambitious and achieved, even if parts within it were slightly over or under.
Okay, well, certainly all of those are critical factors that require special attention, particularly from a CFO throughout a sale process. Can you just please expand on the forecasting accuracy issue, because it tends to be such an important topic an issue for a potential buyer, and how you were able to effectively manage this internally?
So, as I mentioned, we'd implemented Kimball, and that benefited our budgeting, but it also enabled better forecasting on a weekly basis or monthly, and that was paramount, both in terms of managing our business performance, but also exhibiting to potential purchasers the solidity of the business. I think it managed this in part due to the real-time nature of the information and the ease at which we could produce these reports. I mean, they were instantaneous. There was also a little bit more to it. Our sales teams actually became enthusiastic about this tool, which I say with a tone of disbelief because it still surprises me to this day. Once we were live, we didn't have to force it or sell it too much. I mean, they just quickly realized the benefits. And once you have a sales team who are using the system correctly and eagerly, you've won half the battle. So the information in the system was much more accurate. The weighting of the sales was more easily monitored by the head of sales. So if something looked odd, he spotted it and he checked it and corrected it, and therefore it became more accurate. And because we stage gated each percentage increase of an opportunity, it was more difficult for the sales team to erroneously move an opportunity up the ladder without the proper documentation or justification. So why this was all important is our business had a very short cliff. So the work orders that the banks would sign were rarely longer than 6 months, usually, you know, 3 or 4. And so somebody reviewing our business would see this huge drop off in revenue within a scarily short time. But because we were able to illustrate to buyers that the unweighted opportunity still carried a huge degree of realism, that became invaluable. And I produced a report which showed this on a regular basis, and it became a cornerstone report throughout the sales process.
Yeah, certainly, you know, buyers will be absolutely laser focused on the seller's overall pipeline generation and management practices. And having a sophisticated system and well-defined internal processes in place can go a long way to creating buyer confidence in the company's ability to achieve its sales forecasts. Now, without getting too specific for the folks on the line, can you Can you walk me through some of the considerations that that the seller's management team, that you, your executive team had when evaluating the interested buyers still involved in the later stages of the process, just to give some perspective on the actual process itself?
Yes, no problem. During the auction process, we reduced the number of potential purchasers initially based on their offers. We were quite financially focused. However, towards the end of the process, other factors became very crucial. Because we were a service company and our staff were our product, it was vital that we chose the right buyer for the staff as well as management and shareholders. In one case, we had a purchaser and we were concerned that because of historical clashes in culture, this purchaser could antagonize a large number of our staff. So even though that purchaser was offering a very good financial incentive, both to shareholders and to management, as a management team and as a shareholder group, we decided not to pursue it. We felt that it wouldn't be fair to our staff. The main factor towards the end centered around the purchaser's ability to close the deal. So, for example, a very large global consulting company was interested in purchasing and pursued us to the penultimate hurdle. And while we felt that our staff would benefit from the cachet of their brand, at that point we became nervous of their ability to actually close the deal. DD had been ongoing for several months, yet when we were looking to go exclusive, they requested a 3-month extension. And some of the questions they asked during the DD led us to believe they didn't actually quite understand rules business. If they had a 3-month extension and they decided they didn't want this type of business, what would happen to us? Would we have lost the opportunity with our other potential purchasers? Add on top of this the fact that in order to be purchased by one of these global companies, they require several lines of internal approval. So we started to wonder whether their purchasing champion, would he be vetoed at a more senior level down the road for a political reason? We didn't know, and we weren't sure that we could actually risk this time to go exclusive with them. One other thing we monitored was the purchaser's engagement with the VDR. One of the purchasers asked very few questions and barely seemed to engage with the VDR, and we felt that given how far back they were in terms of their DD compared to the others, they wouldn't be able to sign a deal quite quickly. And, you know, by the time, well, this was probably April or May 2014, this in various stages had been ongoing since, you know, mid 2013. At that point, we just wanted to sign the deal and start focusing on the business again. The eventual purchasers seemed to be very organized and motivated. They met every deadline. They asked sensible questions. The COO was a very strong presence on their board, and we felt she had the backing of her board. She'd already considered what she would do with us once she purchased us. That was actually a huge factor for us as well. We also felt culturally the two companies lined up well, and when we discussed exclusivity, she was certain she could do it in an appropriate timeline. They were offering a good price and favorable terms, so it became a no-brainer to go exclusive with them.
Well, that's terrific perspective, and I think you know, our guests on the line should find that insightful and helpful if they're considering either embarking on a sale process or they're currently involved in a sale process and trying to understand how to wade through the buyer universe and sift through to get to the real, you know, interested parties and those committed to closing a deal. That's super critical. How did the board conclude it was the right time to embark on a sale transaction process?
So by mid-2013, when we made the decision, the market was looking very strong. A lot of our investments were reaping rewards, and feedback from the commercial teams was that 2014 would be a good year. And the board knew it would be easiest to sell with increasing monthly revenues in a buoyant market. Some of the management team were disappointed as they wanted to grow the business to 100 million since we were on track to do so. And there were arguments that if 2014 is strong, we should wait till 2015. And we'd laid the foundations of something great. Couldn't we give it more time to make it greater? I personally don't think there is ever a perfect time to sell, but in terms of closing a deal efficiently, you do have to sell it in the backdrop of increasing monthly revenues, and so I think we did choose a good time to sell.
Okay. What did your team perceive were some of the strategic benefits of combining with GFT as you evaluated the buyer proposals?
The main plus for us to go with GFT was their strong balance sheet. So I've mentioned our cash flow constraints earlier, and I've mentioned I've mentioned our cash flow constraints earlier, and because of those constraints, we ended up, I had to kind of stagger our investments to make sure that we didn't overtrade or overexpand and that we would always be cash positive. However, under the GFT umbrella, we believe that we could expand much more rapidly, that there wouldn't be any constraints, and we'd be able to actually open up nearshore centers concurrently. Another small plus for us was the Spanish office. So our Spanish office was very small in number, and it made sense to merge this with a much larger operation, and the GFT had a huge office in Spain, and also to mix the skill set. So that would have both a commercial advantage and obviously an economic advantage. Another commercial benefit was the fact that GFT have very good relationships with leading banks in Germany, and our sales teams were quick in expressing their desire to try leverage those connections. So they were probably the three strategic benefits that we believed could be realized if we were acquired by GFT.
Okay. Yeah. That's super helpful, I'm sure. And the last question we have is an important one. What were some concerns that the buyers expressed to you or to your bankers about the business during the process, and how did you and your bankers mitigate or position around those concerns?
The main big concern, and it isn't very difficult to imagine, was the level of our EBITDA. So even though we've grown it quite significantly from 2011, when it was 1.9%, and we could evidence how that growth was happening over time, it was still a concern raised again and again. And so what we had to do was we had to strip out investments and the purchasing, in inverse commas, of new business with clients and show how that was dragging down the bottom line. Without that, the core business was actually quite healthy. We had to segregate new and old clients to show the difference in gross margins. And I revised prior year and current P&Ls to show which central costs we believe could be excluded in the event that Rural was run by another company or within another company. And we then projected these forward 5 years and showed increasing efficiencies. And that seemed to abate a lot of their concerns. In fact, I think they then saw that as an opportunity, that they could buy this company with a small EBITDA and turn it into something much more profitable. Other issues to tackle was the short cliff of our pipeline and our lack of long-term contracts. While we managed some maintenance contracts, they were a very small percentage of our P&L. So we analyzed unweighted opportunities at the start of previous periods and matched to that the actual outcomes to show how solid the sales book was. So the purchaser could understand how our unweighted opportunities were actually quite realistic, or our weighted ones were quite realistic. A question that arose a few times centered around IP. We had very little IP, as we usually supported the client's creation of IT rather than focused on inventing our own. So where we'd invested in our team creating some IP, we used this as either a sales accelerator or a project accelerator, and we didn't charge separately for it. That said, in the year or two running up to the sale, we realized we had this Achilles heel and directed the Barcelona team to create some IP, and that was quite successful. We ended up selling it, and then they were working on a backlog of other stuff which we could predict would produce future sales, and we showed this to purchasers, and they were interested in that. The one thing that kept coming up with every purchaser was we ended up debating the basis of some of our key KPIs, in particular utilization. And it just seems that every different services company uses a different basis, and every different company believes that theirs was the correct way and the norm across the market. So explaining the calculation and helping them roughly convert it to their methodology was a routine occurrence. If the interested party had a slightly different business and could charge clients for sickness or other non-productive time, they viewed our utilization as too low. But then if, you know, that seemed like a negative, but if you flip that, they then saw that as an opportunity to vastly improve our utilization. Of course, the truth is that when you're charging project by project, client by client, you need to invoice time quite correctly or risk the wrath of a client?
Sure. Okay. Well, I think that's that we're all out of time. I wanted to thank Jillian for her time. This was extraordinarily helpful, I think, for the folks on the line to get some perspective on the challenges and success stories, you know, in a pre-sale context and what works and doesn't work in terms of trying to grow out of certain situations or take advantage of market opportunities. And certainly the success that you had at Rule Financial is very noteworthy, and there are some true lessons that are learned in that time period that you've articulated quite well. So thank you, Jillian, for helping us understand that better, and also for giving us perspective on the M&A sale process of Rule. I think that's also super helpful in the context to provide the context for some of the folks on the line that are looking to thinking about entering into a sale process. Again, this is Matt Hassan, Director at Equitech. I'm available for any follow-up questions. Should anyone on the line have some questions, please feel free to reach out to me directly. And thanks, everyone, for joining today.